Around the year 1650, it became fashionable in London to produce chapbooks. These were cheap books made most ingeniously by the printers of London. A printer would use crude woodcuts and wooden letter blocks to produce a single large sheet of paper, which was then folded into 8, 12, 16 or even 24 pages. And then they were sometimes bound with saddle stitch, and sometimes not, and they eventually were sold door to door by travelling salesmen called chapmen. Chapmen would gain a stock of these books on credit and travel around to the homes and more often than not market stalls and fairs and sell what they could. Anything left over they returned to the printer and after giving him his cut of the profit moved on to sell more books. They were cheap and affordable and often because of this contained nothing but ballads, almanacs, folklore, poetry and other minutiae of literature. And in the year 1656, a writer who described himself only as T.H. produced one such chapbook, which contained a story based on a popular play from about five decades earlier and an equally popular ballad from the same era. The book he produced was known as The Famous and Remarkable History of Sir Richard Whittington. It sold well, we think, and certainly the book and its tale lodged itself into the minds of readers and into the imagination of the residents of London and England as a whole. It was a folklore, and as such, it remained on the edge of culture for the time, becoming beloved of children. By the late 18th century, it had become a puppet play, and going forward became an opera and eventually a pantomime, where Richard Whittington is often portrayed by a young woman in tight leggings and an oversized shirt. There exists now a multitude of versions of this tale, and it is remarkably lovely. See, according to this story, Dick Whittington was a poor orphan boy, who may or may not have come from Lancashire or elsewhere, and at a tender age, he decided to set off to seek his fortune in London, where supposedly the streets were paved with gold. Upon arriving there, Dick Whittington discovered a much harsher place, and cold and hungry, he fell asleep at the gate of the home of a wealthy London merchant called Fitzwarren. Upon discovering the orphan on the street outside his gate, Fitzwarren took pity on the waif, and made him a kitchen scullion. Whittington was allowed to sleep in the merchant's garret and discovered it was infested with rats and mice. Whittington then supplemented his meagre salary by shining rich men's shoes, and with the few pennies he'd managed to cobble together, he was able to purchase for himself a cat, which soon not only dealt with all the rats and the mice in the garret, also became Whittington's one and true only friend. Meanwhile, his employer, Fitzwarren, had organised a trade expedition, and the merchant demanded all his household contribute to the expedition in some way, and so he demanded of his young kitchen scullion his only companion, the cat. Upset and heartbroken, and also obviously incredibly poor and now without his friend, young Whittington decided to flee from his life as a kitchen scullion. He fled London, and according to the story, got as far as Dunhill or Holloway. And there he heard in the distance the Bow Bells, the bells of Bow Church, which he felt were tolling out the words, turn again, Whittington, thrice Mayor of London. Young Dick Whittington resolved to stay and returned back to his lonely life in the garret. Meanwhile, his master's ship was caught out in bad weather and ended up in North Africa, where the local King of the Moors decided to buy the entire cargo they contained and entertained the crew as guests of his at a lavish feast. The feast, however, was infested by mice and rats, and one of the English crew informed the king that they had on their ship a creature who was especially skilled in dealing with such animals, Dick Whittington's cat. The cat was duly brought ashore and had a great fun destroying all the rats and mice, and upon discovery that the cat was pregnant, the Moorish king paid handsomely for the entire litter of kittens, 10 times more than the amount of money he'd paid for the rest of the cargo. The ship returned to London, and Fitzwarren, upon being informed, summoned his scullion Dick Whittington, and told him that his fortune had been made, and from His cut of the expedition, which was generated by his contribution, the cat, he was now richer than his old master, and the profits of the sales of those kittens were entirely his. His fortune now made, Dick Whittington married his former master's daughter Alice and joined his now father-in-law in business. In time, Whittington became the Lord Mayor of London three times, just as the bells had predicted. It's a lovely, lovely story. Of course, it's also total bollocks. The real story of Richard Whittington is an insight into a very turbulent time in London and speaks of power politics and economic crisis. It's a tale of an increasingly eccentric king and an increasingly nervous city. And it's a tale of wealth, power, and political survival. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of London in regular weekly chunks, a chronological narrative. We have reached the last years of the 14th century, and we're going to examine the rise of Richard Whittington to his first term out of four terms as mayor. It's a heck of a tale. Much more interesting, even if it doesn't involve a cat. Welcome then to chapter 142 of The Story of London, The Harsh Truth of Dick Whittington and His Cat. Alright, so we are in London around the year 1394, and the city was hectic and busy. It was filled with people all trying to make a living as around them England, and by extension Northern Europe, was undergoing a serious economic downturn due to a lack of silver, which in turn spawned a lack of coins, which in turn created a credit shortage. The city, back then as now, functioned on the use of credit to facilitate financial operations, and as such, economic activity in the city was severely depressed. Because of all this, you could best describe it that times were hard. But still, London persevered and went forward. The mayor in 1394 was a man called John Freshey. Freshey was a London-based political heavyweight. He'd been around during the last dozen chapters of The Story of London, mostly in the background of a lot of the stuff that had been going on, and he, well, if anybody sounds like a prototype for Dick Whittington, it's him. Freshey's origins are unknown to historians, but we do know in 1373 he married the daughter of a rich London merchant, and at least one historian assumed he was an apprentice who married the youngest daughter of his master. From then on, and for the next 20 years, he had risen in the political scene of London alongside the rising in importance Mercer's Company. He had become the alderman of Bashingshaw Ward, which was the small ward bordered by Cheapside, Aldersgate, Coleman Street and Cripplegate. In December 1380, he'd been chosen to be one of young King Richard II's collectors of the London poll tax, an unpopular job, and because of that he'd been right at the heart of London politics when the Peasants' Revolt had erupted. Freshey had been one of the three aldermen sent to meet Wat Tyler by the mayor and was part of that group later accused of encouraging the men of Kent to march out in the city and perhaps attack Marshalsea Prison. Despite being accused of this, he was never convicted of this allegation, and as such he returns to being a mercer and did well out of it. As a mercer, he was heavily involved in exporting wool and also got into moneylending, becoming one of London's richest and most prominent leaders. During this era, he had clashed with John de Northampton, and it was this period that saw Freshey accused of not only encouraging the burning of the Marshalsea Prison, but also of having been one of a group of aldermen who had encouraged that brewer to try and burn the Jubilee Book back during the chaos on the streets. We covered this on two chapters about the Peasants' Revolt, so I won't go over it too much again. Because of that allegation, Freshey had been arrested and confined to the Tower of London, but with the fall of John de Northampton, this mercer with strong ties to the grocers was released. Freshey had served as Sheriff of London and was closely aligned to Nicholas Brembe and Nicholas Exton, and went on to be elected the Alderman of Cordwainer Ward in 1385. Despite being on the receiving end of some of Richard II's politics, Freshey had retained royal favour. And here we are in 1394 going into 1395, and he was Mayor of London. His knowledge of the Cordwainer district as the alderman had probably come in handy for him, as his term as office is most remembered for him solving an ongoing dispute between the Cordwainers, the makers of leather shoes, and the cobblers, the repairers of leather shoes. These two professions had been at odds for some time, it seems, over who has jurisdiction to mess with the other's profession. And Freshie's solution was to force representatives of the two crafts to sit down, and a compromise agreement was made, wherein, quote, that no person who meddles with old shoes shall meddle with new shoes to sell, and that every manner of work that may be made of new leather belongs to new workers, without them meddling with any old work to sell, unquote. So yeah, the Cordwainers made nice new shoes and could deal with only them, and the cobblers repaired old shoes and could deal with only them. Freshie was mayor in charge of London, however, when the king did something that was seen as rather disturbing, extreme. And this extreme thing he partook in happened just down the river in Richmond. It was here that the kings of England, ever since the reign of Henry I, had possessed the manor house of Sheen. Over the years, the manor at Sheen had become a place the kings of England had lavished attention upon. And by the time of Richard II, it was a palace, supposedly large enough to entertain thousands for dinner. The previous king, Edward III, had established a significant household in the place, which included royal chaplains, an apothecary, a full-time physician. There were several butlers and tailors, there were numerous carpenters and smiths, and it garrisoned hundreds of soldiers, and of course had apartments for the great officers of his court. Richard II had added to this by constructing a grand bathhouse, and he seemed to favour visiting Sheen in October and November of the year, usually before going on to spend his Christmases in Westminster. And here he would stage elaborate events. His queen, Anne of Bohemia, who had introduced the horn cap into the fashions of the country, had helped make Sheen Palace a spectacular and extravagant place. She had not only her own apartments there, but she also had designed some gardens there. Queen Anne of Bohemia cuts an enigmatic figure in this era. Richard and his bride had been brought together by the needs of international diplomacy alone, but all the evidence suggests that their marriage had actually become one of actual love and genuine affection. We know little about Queen Anne. Her arrival in England aroused pitifully little interest in the chronicles of the time, and one contemporary writer actually described her as, quote, this tiny scrap of humanity, unquote. Even now, in the story, a dozen years after she had arrived, writers could only offer bland descriptions of her character. She was kind to the poor and the needy. Anne of Bohemia, it seems, played absolutely no part in the politics of the era. Her few interventions into national stage politics was confined to acts of intercession and mercy. In 1388, she pleaded with the Lords Appellants for the lives of Sir Simon Burley and the royal justices, and 4 years later she begged her husband to show forgiveness to the Londoners over the unpaid fine they had. It was the convention of the age for queens and royal consorts to act in this way, and it should come as no surprise that the only surviving manuscript illumination of Queen Anne of Bohemia shows her in this capacity. By all accounts, it appears as if Queen Anne of Bohemia was quite content with her role as the gentle and merciful Queen of England, and she clearly held no ambition for greater political power. This being said, it's also clear that she was rather intelligent and educated. She could read and write German, Latin, and Czech, and records indicate she was learning to read the Bible in English. She was becoming the patron of new Christian traditions, and in 1382 she had sought permission from the Pope for the feast of her patron saint, Saint Anne, to be celebrated, quote, more solemnly, unquote, in England. And there is evidence from 1390 she began to earn the respect of the English political elite. She gained a modest reputation for being skilled in settling disputes gracefully. Had she lived, she might have emerged as a figure of considerable political stature. But in 1394, while she was still only in her 20s, the Queen was struck down, possibly by the plague during a small eruption of the disease. We don't know for sure. Richard and his Queen had been married for just over 12 years, and as stated, their relationship had been close. Unusually for a royal couple, they had travelled together on all their major journeys. In 1382 and 1383, Richard had taken her on two lengthy tours around his realm to introduce her to his subjects. On the rare occasions they had been separated, we know they kept in touch by letter, and there are no records of any infidelity on either side. Most striking about their marriage is, of course, the issue of them having no children. Given Richard's need for an heir, this does suggest that either he was infertile or she was unable to conceive. But ultimately, King Richard was deeply distraught at her sudden death. According to one writer at the time, for a full year, he would not enter any chamber that she had been in. And in the depths of his grief and sorrow, the young king ordered the Grand Palace of Sheen to be destroyed, torn down in an act of destructive mourning. On the whole, it was, but some buildings did remain, mostly to barrack soldiers. But this irrational and grief-filled act seemed to display a deeper flaw in the king's character. This was extreme. Still, what could the city do, or this mayor? They just carried on, a city of busy people and lost places. Lost places like the Cheapside Standard. This was a large wooden fountain located in Cheapside, and our first records of it appear in 1395. It was supplied with water from the River Walbrook, and it was located at the end of Honey Lane, almost opposite the Church of St. Mary Le Bow. It was to remain a prominent Cheapside landmark for some centuries. Now it's completely forgotten about, mostly. But as well as lost places in London in this era, we also have lost events happen, moments that were really shocking and big at the time, but we forget about them nowadays. And that included the deaths of several Londoners due to a sudden lack of crowd control. You see, the king had decided very quickly to marry again. As unhinged as he had seemingly become at the death of his queen, Anne of Bohemia, he was the king, and kings had queens and heirs to the throne and of all of that. So once again, the king needed to get married, and once again, his bride was to be chosen due to the needs of international diplomacy. The by now 60-year war with France was possibly slowly moving towards a peaceful resolution. Both the kings of the two nations were tired of the strains the fighting had placed on their nation's finances, and what was going on these days was a series of extended truces punctuated by small eruptions of violence now and then. King Richard wanted to push this agenda forward a little, so it should come as no surprise that he leaped at the chance to marry a French princess, a daughter of the French king. Now, although it could be surprising to realise that his bride was only 6 years old. Now, before everybody starts freaking out, the royal marriage was not like that. The Princess Isabella was only six when she was handed over to Richard in 1396 at Ardennes, and possibly only seven when she arrived back in England. The age difference meant that the relationship between them could never, for several years to come, be that of a normal husband and wife. It appeared in all respects that it was a relationship that acted closer to father and daughter. Richard does appear to have treated the young Isabella as the child that he'd never had. We know he indulged in various whims and fancies, and at Christmas and other festivals, he showered her with presents. There's one recorded moment where the Bishop of Durham gave the king a present of a whistle inlaid with precious stones, and he instantly handed it over to her. Her standing in England was closely related to the fortunes of the ongoing Anglo-French peace talks, which she was the personification of in human form. But ultimately, yeah, the Queen She's seven. To the residents of London, this was a bit... Yeah, it's a bit bougie, mate. Sorry, this was weird. No, it was. I mean, even if there were big diplomatic reasons behind it, and even if he isn't going to lay a finger on her in that way, you know, he's a king without an heir. And his new wife was a kid. Like, what? What the hell? And then it was heard she was turning up. And this the residents of London had got to see. So, in 1396, the aging but highly respected London political giant Adam Bam was now mayor. And the king and his bride arrived in Blackheath. And the mayor and the aldermen went out to meet the royal couple. And as they did, London came out in force to see the king and his new, very, very young bride. The plan was for the mayor and aldermen to escort the new royal couple back along the south side of the river, cross London Bridge, turn right, and process to the Tower of London. And all went to plan until they reached the narrow confines off London Bridge. At the bridge, so great were the crowds, mawkishly wishing to catch sight of this young girl, that there was a crush. Now, the authorities made sure that the king and queen could make their way on in safety, but this caused the crush to push back on those pushing forwards. And the records say that seven people died on London Bridge that day. Once again, Richard II and the large crowd of Londoners had become acquainted. And once again, the result was death. He's making a habit of this, you know. Overall, though, there was a change in the temperament of the king going forward, and nobody could ignore it. I could spend hours talking about the character and the deeds of Richard II in his latter years, and I could still not do the subject justice. Luckily, I can focus upon London in this narrative, which means I can just give a short summation of what was going on and ignore the rest. Because in 1397, Richard's rulership style seemed to dramatically change. Now, his rulership style, as London had discovered a few years earlier, was pretty petty and autocratic. But the opportunity now arose for him to act like this much more confidently with the rest of the country. There was political tension in the realm. Not everyone liked this new peace process going on with the French. Not everyone was happy with the new advisors rising up in the king's court. And several people were looking to the old Lords of Pallant, who had once put Richard in his place, to maybe remind him to, you know, stay in his box. And then that June, Adam Bam, the mayor of London, died. The death of this political heavyweight was quite a thing for London. Bam had been very popular after his first term in office. He had ordered the purchase of large amounts of grain to try and offset the effects of a famine we'd mentioned just a few chapters ago, and he'd been the mayor who had ordered that no one was to bring up the feud between Brembe and John de Northampton. In effect, Adam Bam was the face of the new political rapprochement within London's internal factions. He died on June the 6th, 1397. And King Richard moved swiftly to make sure that his dominion over London continued unbroken by appointing his choice to be acting mayor for the next few months until the mayoral elections. And his choice for mayor was Richard Whittington. And this is where Dick Whittington enters our story properly. Alas, Dick was not an orphan or a pauper. As far as we can tell, Whittington was born in and around 1354, the third son of a wealthy family from Gloucestershire. His family were big fish in very local small ponds. His father was Sir William Whittington, the MP for the region. His mother Joan was the daughter of another MP who'd been Sheriff of Gloucestershire. And his two older brothers were born to inherit their father's estate and political heft. The eldest of his brothers, William, served as an MP and was the inheritor of the mainstay of his father's estate. And the next son along, Robert, was actually to serve as MP for Gloucestershire six times. As the third son, Richard Whittington was not really expected to inherit a damn thing. and thus was most probably sent to London to learn the craft of a mercer via an apprenticeship. Sadly, at this point, we have no evidence of him ever living in a rat-infested garret or purchasing a cat. He seems to have learned the craft of a mercer and studied well, earning trust and a growing reputation as a merchant-to-be. By his early 30s, then, we see him as a successful merchant in his own right within London's walls. Like many mercers, he specialised in importing luxury cloths, silks and velvets, to be sold onto the nobility and the royal court, and he was doing this from 1388. We suspect, but are not 100% sure, that he may have doubled his investments by being involved in the export of woollen cloths from England, like broadcloths. And after a few years, he certainly seems to have found a way to sell directly to the crown itself. We know from 1392 to 1394, he sold goods to the king which amounted to about £3,500, which in today's money comes in at about £4 million worth of goods. He was clearly successful and was known to the king and the rich of the court. And he was chartering or even owning his own ships to facilitate his import and export trade. We also know in the late 1380s and early 1390s, he got into the business of lending money, extending credit and coin, which, given the situation economically at the time, was a much more prudent investment. And by 1397, we know he had begun to lend large sums of cash to the ever-needy king. In many ways, Richard II appointing Dick Whittington as interim mayor was a king trying to give a reward to the mercer who is now granting him monies. It wasn't much, but it's something. But Whittington at this moment clearly appeared to understand the difficulty this appointment placed him in. He was now mayor of London, sworn in 2 days after the popular Adam Bam had died, and he was clearly the king's man. Tradition dictated that Londoners never responded well to royal appointments running their city, and he could very easily find himself becoming a figure of dislike and hatred within the city. And added to this, the king now was seeking more cash, and as such, he'd turned to Whittington more and more now he'd given him this powerful position. Dick Whittington had to find a solution to these issues he faced, and surprisingly enough, he prudently found one very quickly. Within days of being appointed, Richard Whittington negotiated with the King of England the full restoration of all the traditional rights and liberties of London, all of them that had been lost over the last few decades. Of course, this wasn't free. The city would pay for it, a grant which cost London £10,000, roughly £9.5 million in today's money. And while the mercers and the grocers had already gained what they wished with the restoration of London's trading privileges a few years earlier, this was the very expensive but tasty icing on that cake. Richard Whittington's popularity quickly soared. And 4 months later, he was formally elected as mayor, technically his second term, by the Aldermen of London on the 13th of October, 1397. Richard Whittington ultimately was not some outsider. He'd been a member of the Common Council as far back as 1384. By 1393, he'd become an alderman of the city. And as we covered last episode, under the then King's candidate for mayor, William Staunton, he had served as sheriff of the city for a year. This mercer was very much part of the political establishment of London, and he had just used his position within the court as a financier of the kingdom to actually help remove London from the sticky nature of courtly politics, to a degree, by getting a new charter for the city. Dick Whittington had proved very quickly to be a very canny political operator, and given the king was being seen as increasingly autocratic and oddly behaving, this made his choices especially useful, because his term of office was to see the political situation elsewhere in England turn dark. By the spring and early summer of 1397, King Richard's relations with three of the former Lords Appellants had become increasingly tense. They were older now, weaker, and he still harboured resentments to the humiliation he had experienced, which we told back in chapter 139. But the thing was, they kind of suspected it, and their followers were on the defensive. There was an atmosphere of suspicion towards the king, and Richard began to feel threatened. He decided during this time to strike first. He decided to go after the Earl of Warwick, his uncle, the Duke of Gloucester, and the Earl of Arundel. The fullest and most colourful version of what follows says the king invited these three lords to a banquet in London on the 10th of July. Mayor Whittington certainly would have heard of it and was probably invited. Of the three guests, only the Earl of Warwick attended. The Duke of Gloucester pleaded ill health, staying at his castle in nearby Pleshey, while the Earl of Arundel, who earlier the year had declined to attend a royal council meeting, also declined this invitation, staying in his castle at Reigate. Richard pretended friendship to the Earl of Warwick over the dinner, but at the end of it, he dramatically had him arrested, and immediately he gave orders for the arrest of the other two nobles. Archbishop Arundel was sent off to try and persuade his brother to give himself up, but King Richard himself undertook to get his uncle, the Duke of Gloucester. The accounts say that the king decided there and then to march on Plessy. At his command, an enormous retinue of peers, household men, and London artisans were assembled. London artisans, of course, meant that Whittington, as mayor of London, plus no doubt leading members of the aldermanry, was summoned to join in this royal posse. Whittington was now part of the king's clampdown on his old rivals, and found himself marching on the estate of one of the sons of King Edward III. This force supposedly set out by the dead of night. Many of the members apparently were ignorant of where they were going exactly, and arrived at the castle before dawn. The Duke of Gloucester was roused from his sleep and came down attended only by a few clerks. King Richard bowed to him, exchanged a few courtesies, and then personally arrested his uncle. A small section of the royal retinue entered the castle with the king, inspected the chapel, and took breakfast. Richard then ordered the Duke to make his farewells, and after packing his bags, he was taken away to be kept imprisoned in Calais. One can imagine the feelings of the Londoners as they returned home later that day. They'd just seen the Duke of Gloucester, once a hated figure in the city, arrested and detained. They may well have been supportive of this. But as word of the king's pogrom against his enemies began to filter out from the aldermen to their staff, to their neighbours and across the streets, London could well have worried about the monarch's temperament and mind state. This was all a revenge for past slights? At least London had paid for forgiveness to the myriad of past slights upon the king, but there would have been alarm over where this was going. I mean, so great was the alarm that King Richard actually offered reassurances. On the 15th of July, he ordered the sheriffs of England to proclaim that the lords had been arrested for new offences and had nothing to do with their role in what happened back in 1387 and 88, and that those who had ridden with them then in that year had no cause for alarm. And at the same time, on the 13th of July, an order was sent to the Sheriff of Cheshire to recruit 2,000 archers as a matter of priority. These 2,000 archers were to serve the king directly. A month later, on the 20th of August, further orders were sent to the sheriffs to arrange for all those in the king's pay to array themselves and assemble at Kingston-upon-Thames on the 15th of September. Something was going down. Writs were issued for a parliament to meet at Westminster on the 17th of September. And that parliament was an odd one. I mean, all of London would have known that work was being done on Westminster Hall that September. It was entirely out of use. And because of this, a temporary wooden structure had to be erected in the palace yard to house the gathering. It was basically a wooden roof with pillars holding it up without walls. This location made it unusual. What made it even more unusual was that in contravention of the usual protocols, the powerful nobles of England were allowed to bring their retinues with them. Why would the king allow this? Well, it appeared that King Richard himself appeared with a force of over 300 archers from Cheshire to intimidate the gathering. He had these men flanking the open-sided buildings, which added a clear air of menace to what was to follow. London had witnessed many parliaments down the river in Westminster, but none quite like the one held that September. The London MPs and the mayor would have seen on the first day the Bishop of Exeter, on behalf of the king, giving a barnstorming sermon, clearly laying out the ground rules for what was to come. This was about the king gaining and exercising his power to rule the land as God intended. The London MPs would have perhaps noticed that there were a lot of new faces here. The king had stacked the commons with representatives who were chosen by the sheriffs he'd spent the last few years appointing. The day after this, things began in earnest. Gloucester, Arundel and Warwick were to be tried for treason. The first was the trial of the Earl of Arundel, and apparently this was a barnstormer. It was really quite exciting to watch by all accounts. With the young king sitting presiding over it all, his powerful old uncle, John of Gaunt, aka the Duke of Lancaster, presided as the main trial official, and he told the Earl of Arundel that the previous pardon he'd been granted by the king for the actions he took back in the day in the Tower of London was now null and void, with the words, quote, "Your pardon is revoked, traitor," unquote. Arundel replied, "Truly you lie. Never was I a traitor." Lancaster supposedly retorted with, "Why in that case did you seek a pardon?" To which Arundel replied, "To silence the tongues of my enemies, of whom you are one." This may have scored a point, because at this point the young king leans forward and demands, "Answer the appeal." Arundel immediately becomes far more sanguine. One can imagine him now realising that actually the king's behind this. And he says, "I see it all now. You who accuse me, you're all liars. I claim the benefit of my pardon, which you granted when you were of full age." The king, having been caught out on this, peevishly retorted, "I granted it provided it were not to my prejudice." And at this, the Duke of Lancaster declared, "The pardon is worthless." And immediately, the newly elected Speaker of the House of Commons then added, "The pardon has been revoked by the King, the Lords, and by us, the faithful Commons." And at that, Arundel looked round the room, saw all the strangers, laughed and said, "Where are the faithful Commons?" It must have made brilliant drama. But it served no purpose apart from fascination. Arundel was found guilty of treason that day, dragged from Westminster to Tower Hill, and was beheaded there and then. The trial of the Earl of Warwick happened on the following Friday. This was not as dramatic at all. The Earl was poorly and he cut quite a pathetic figure. One source claimed that he was, quote, "like a wretched old woman," unquote, and that after, quote, "sobbing and whining," unquote, confessed to everything. King Richard, taking pity on him, commuted the initial death sentence to banishment for life on the Isle of Man. And then was supposed to come the trial for the Duke of Gloucester, the king's uncle. But the trial never happened. The Duke had been kept prisoner in Calais, and when he'd been sent for, it was discovered that the Duke had died. But luckily, he did sign a confession, which was useful, just before he died. And the king could use that to justify a guilty verdict. All sorted. Yes, this was certainly not suspicious at all. Nope, no sir, nothing suspicious at all going on here. A few years from now, in testimony given to Parliament and recorded in our parliamentary records, a man called John Hall later confessed to the crime of murdering the Duke of Gloucester. Hall described how on royal orders, he and half a dozen accomplices had dragged the Duke from his cell and suffocated him under a feather bed in a back room of a Calais hostel. The murder method was done to prevent there being any suspicious marks on his body, and appears to have been carried out on the 9th of the 8th of September. See, King Richard did not actually want the show trial with the Duke of Gloucester to go ahead, partly because he feared that the well-known eloquence of the Duke may have swayed those listening, But crucially, his older brother, the Duke of Lancaster, was running the trials, and he may have refused to pass judgment on his baby brother. But as it is, no trial was needed. Everything's fine. Let's move on. Next. The story of Dick Whittington, then, was not some tale of a rags-to-riches rise of a young pauper in the city where the streets are lined with gold. It's the story of a canny political operator, a successful merchant and financier, who leveraged being thrust into this core political position, into gaining concessions for London and, crucially, keeping London out of this new and bloodthirsty spasm of the King's regime. Richard II came out of that parliament firmly in charge of the apparatus of state. He was slowly going through his former enemies one by one, elevating himself as the only power in the realm, and anyone and everyone who opposed him or who he was suspicious of was now a target. The story of the rise of Richard Whittington was a story of how one man helped keep London out of this. They paid the king a large sum of money, got a charter, and were loyal in the king's eyes. Whittington ultimately was a survivor, and as mayor, he used these skills to steer London through the turbulent political waters around them, and probably saved the city also. Ultimately, this act of political survival, given that within a year or so, the king would be toppled and a new regime was to take control of the state. This act was to be Whittington's first of several great legacies he was to bequeath to London. And the harsh truth of his life is that the folklore story of the pauper and his cat does not give credit to the skilled and talented man who did this for London. And I'm going to leave it there. Next week, let us talk of the death of kings, the fall of Richard II, and the rise of Henry Bolingbroke. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week for another episode. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star review or a positive review. And we'll leave it there. See you then. Bye.